Bonjour, je suis heureux de vous accueillir cet après-midi pour la conférence du professeur Hayes que je vais vous présenter dans une minute. Vous avez déjà le titre, c'est la nourrice divine dans la critique prophétique. La nourrice divine, c'est tout un programme que vous allez découvrir très vite. Pour présenter le professeur Hayes, il est donc professeur du Proche-Orient ancien. À la Fuller Theological Seminary, qui est Pasadena, en Californie. Il a fait ses études à Princeton et à Emory, donc à Atlanta. Il s'est spécialisé sur la question justement des relations entre la Bible hébraïque et le contexte proche-oriental. Très souvent, quand on fait ça, on s'intéresse à la Mésopotamie, à la Syrie, Et M. Hayes s'est plutôt spécialisé, sans évidemment se focaliser entièrement, à la relation entre la Bible et l'Égypte. Et donc ça va bien avec ce que nous avons fait avec Joseph et l'Égypte. Donc je me suis dit, c'est un bon prolongement. Donc là, ce sera par rapport à un tout autre texte, un texte prophétique, mais pour lequel il a des idées assez intéressantes. M. Hayes a évidemment publié beaucoup, donc je ne vais pas vous donner la liste, ça vous pouvez le découvrir dans son site, mais je voudrais juste mentionner deux livres. Donc le premier est assez en lien avec de ce qu'il va nous dire. Death in the Iron Age 2 and in the First Isaiah, donc la question de la mort dans le premier Ésaïe et puis dans l'Âge de Fer 2. Et ce livre a en fait deux éditions, une édition européenne et une édition américaine. L'édition européenne coûte 4 fois le prix de l'édition américaine, donc voilà. It's exactly the same or it's
just a few fixes.
Voilà, donc je vous le fais passer, si vous voulez faire la critique textuelle, vous pouvez le faire. Ça, c'est... Mais après, il faut que je le récupère. Hein, donc... Enfin, ça disparaît, ça, je ne sais pas trop. Et puis, après, il y a un autre livre très intéressant qui vient de sortir, s'appelle « Hidden Riches ». Ça, c'est en fait un livre dans lequel il nous donne, pour les grands textes de la Bible hébraïque, des textes du Proche-Orient ancien qui ont un rapport assez immédiat avec ces textes. Donc au lieu d'aller chercher un peu partout Arika, Gilgamesh, la sagesse de Amenopée et d'autres, vous avez tout cela dans le même livre, avec des commentaires qui montrent à la fois le lien, les différences, les possibilités diachroniques qu'on peut en déduire. Donc c'est un livre, je trouverais, ce serait bien aussi de le traduire en français. Donc j'ai vu sur Joseph, il a choisi Arika, dont je vous ai également parlé. Donc là, vous avez les deux ensemble. Donc je fais également passer une sexualité. Et puis voilà, sans tarder, je lui donne la parole. Donc, nous remercions d'être venu nous parler. Donc, vous avez reçu le texte du chapitre 28 du livre d'Ésaïe pour que vous puissiez suivre. Et évidemment, il y a beaucoup d'images. Donc, mettez-vous de sorte que vous pouvez bien voir les images. Thank you very much again. Il va parler en anglais. Par contre, le PowerPoint est en français. C'est presque comme des sous-titres d'une certaine manière. Voilà. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Romer, for the kind introduction. It's a great honor to be here with you all in Paris, and I particularly am grateful for your forbearance in allowing me to lecture in English, which will probably go better. So I'd like to start with the background of the problem that led me to this lecture, which, as Professor Romer mentioned, came out of my first book, in which I was working on Isaiah 28, which is a central text in Proto-Isaiah, which concerns imagery of death. It talks about a covenant with death. And so in Isaiah's rhetoric there, as I'll get to in more detail in just a minute, he picks up on this imagery of the divine wet nurse. And so I like to think more broadly now about that topic and how this 8th century prophet fits into that conversation. I'll make one methodological comment also at the outset, which is that there are two subfields or two domains of knowledge which I think have often been undervalued by scholars in my field of Hebrew Bible, and both of them become very significant here. One is Egyptian data, and one is iconography, the way in which ancient artifacts and images inform our interpretation of the Bible. So you have on your handout the text of Isaiah 28, and I encourage you to sort of follow along with me there as I talk. I'm going to move fairly quickly. For those of you who are specialists, who want all the details, all the argumentation about some of these points, you can find those in the book and in two articles which I've written, which are on the back of your handout. I'll just note first that in this passage we have very diverse imagery. And in the past this has led scholars to assume that this must have been composed in many layers and then somehow compiled into this unholy combination that makes very little sense. I think that's probably the wrong approach to this diversity. So I'll start with the imagery of torrential storms or floods from which people are seeking protection in the passage. What is this threat that people want protection from? This is almost universally recognized as a symbol of the Neo-Assyrian military, which is imagery which the Assyrians use both in their own inscriptions and which we can see also in the Bible. So in Isaiah 8, we see that God brings against the nation the king of Assyria, who is portrayed as powerful, great waters. And as I mentioned, in the Assyrians' own inscription, kings such as Tiglath-Pileser I and Esarhaddon both also portrayed themselves as a flood, this unstoppable natural force. Then the question becomes in the passage, who is it that Judah makes this covenant with? Who is the covenant with death? Who is death? Just to set the scene for those who are less immersed in all this, this is the world of the 8th century. Here's Judah in the middle, Jerusalem as the capital here. And in the 8th century, the Assyrians were a rising, fast-expanding power. So they were pressuring all of the Levantine cities and states from the north and east. And under that pressure from Mesopotamia, they were quite prone to seek out alliances with Egypt. Indeed, Isaiah condemns treaties with Egypt in more than one place in the proto-Isaianic material in the book, where he is a kind of a separatist. He doesn't want Judah to be making alliances with foreign countries, but to have trust in their own resources and in their own God. At the same time, of course, we had widespread trading contacts, mostly through the seacoast, also between Judah and Egypt, and we'll see some of the cultural effects of that in just a minute. So many scholars have concluded that this covenant with death ought to be seen as one with Egypt, but no one had really advanced a compelling argument for how Egypt should be called death. Why should one make that connection? So in my work, I've argued that in fact that can be explained through this Egyptian goddess named Mut. Now her name in Egyptian is transliterated MWT, and so if one knows Hebrew, then the play on the Hebrew word for death, mavet, or in the Judean pronunciation of the time, probably more like maut, would be probably fairly clear. And Mut also means to die in both languages, both in Hebrew and Egyptian. So this whole thing, death, the goddess's name, all fits together rather neatly. In Egyptian, Mut also means mother, which is a topic that I'll come back to in just a moment. So the phonology of ancient Egyptian, as some of you may know, is a poorly understood topic. Egyptologists themselves are often at a loss for how Egyptian ought to be vocalized, but there's reason to think that these two words would have sounded very similar. In later Greek transcription, both the goddess's name and the Semitic god of death's name are both spelled in the same way, Mut, as you see at the bottom of the slide. But it's not just the name of the goddess. Since I'm in Paris, I'll share this, even though I actually use this in talks for years. For those who object that perhaps the sound might not have been perfectly right, my point has always been that a pun doesn't have to fit precisely to work. So here's this joke: if you jump off a Paris bridge, you are insane. Well, one doesn't say sane quite in French. It's sen, right? It's a shorter vowel, but it still works. So when the hearers first heard this phrase, you have made a covenant with Mut. First they would have heard Mut, and then in the next line, as you can see on your handout, you've made a pact with Sheol. So it sort of clarifies or shifts the sense of the meaning that hearers would have first heard. So it's an artful play on words by the prophet. So Mut fits the context in various ways. She was at a peak of her popularity under the 25th Cushite and 26th Saite dynasties, which is also Isaiah's period. At that time, there were cults of Mut all around the Egyptian delta, and the building of her temples accelerated. She was known as the wife of Amun-Re, who was the chief national deity of the Cushites in particular. This is a photo of the temple of Mut at Napata in modern Jebel Barkal, which was the capital of the Cushite dynasty in Isaiah's time. And the prophet Minshu Imit of Amun at Karnak during the 26th dynasty wrote, "I have renewed the temple of Mut the Great so that it is more beautiful than before." So thus Mut was a national goddess of great popularity in Egypt during Isaiah's time. She's also a goddess who is particularly linked to kingship, protection, and covenants. She was a symbol of the nation and its power. She's called a king in a Ramesside period hymn, the king of Upper and Lower Egypt. She has no equal. Her manifestation on earth is kingship. In her relationship to the king, she's also a guarantor of covenants. We see on Pia's victory stela here, this is from the year 725, when Pia, a Cushite pharaoh, campaigned to conquer the Egyptian delta. And you see he has all the peoples whom he's conquered bowing down to him. He's standing, here's the god Amun, and here is Mut, who sort of stands behind the whole situation, blessing it. So she's one of the guarantors of that covenant. She was also the one who, as you see at the bottom, enforced those treaties. So if they were broken, and this apparently happened historically, that the king who broke the treaty or others who were responsible might be burned cultically in one of her sacred spaces. So we have ritual texts which attest to that. Thus, it might well make sense that one would speak about making a covenant with Mut. Mut also had a strong aspect as a protectress. We have here, this is earlier, but it's a sculpture of a queen named Mutimwiya. This is in the British Museum. It's a beautiful piece. It's got the top broken off, but you noticed on a previous slide, Mut's name is written with the vulture hieroglyph. And so here she's portrayed with protective wings wrapped around this queen who's named for her. And the queen's name means Mut in a bark. So that's it's a play on the queen's name, Mut in a boat, if you will. And she also had protective aspects later on. So in the tomb of Simut from the 13th century, he says that the one who Mut makes a protege, nothing bad can attack him. So she's a strong protectress of those who worship her. And therefore, when we read in Isaiah 28 that they've taken her as a protection from the flood, this is not surprising. We can go farther. Drunkenness was also a major feature of the cult of Mut. So in a 25th dynasty stela from Tel Edfu, we read, O Mut, celestial and solar goddess who is the first ranked in Isheru, he inebriates himself for you, the priest of Amun, who resides at Karnak. Protect this man who inebriates himself for the golden goddess. So somehow drunkenness was linked to communion with the divine, which is not a surprising idea in the history of religions in general. Of course, in Isaiah 28, Isaiah condemns this state as leading not to protection or to knowledge of the goddess, but rather simply to bad decision making. We can even, as a final note, go so far as to link some of the floral or flower imagery from the passage to actual historical practice. So Mut is called in one of her crossword hymns the Lady of the Lotus, whose face is associated with the lotus. And of course, floral offerings were commonly given in her cult, as in the Egyptian cult of the dead. That's certainly not a feature exclusive to her cult, but certainly a plausible detail. So in Isaiah 28, we read that the proud garland of the Ephraimites will be trampled, and we read that instead Yahweh will be the garland. Yahweh will be the glorious flower, taking the place of what Isaiah views as a false goddess in the person of Mut. So Isaiah puts his own spin on these customs. But I want to emphasize this point here. I do believe that there's a historical reality underlying this passage, that he's actually criticizing something that was taking place. That's not to say that what he describes is exactly what actually happened. It's the prophet's own portrayal, which, like anything else in the Bible, has its own ideological angle to it. So that's a subtle distinction that I want to guard here. Finally, I'll just note that it's not merely a hypothesis that Mut was known in the time of Isaiah in Judah. In fact, we have amulets like the ones on the slide, which show that she was known. These are found all over Israel and Judah and other places in the central Levant during the Iron Age II. Some of these I'll talk more about in a minute have the name or word Mut written on them. So even though the goddess situation is complicated, she's known. Here's one more. She's also strongly associated with the lion goddess Sekhmet, or cat goddess, as her sort of angry, vengeful side. And so some of these amulets which portray Sekhmet may also have been associated with Mut. And finally, I'll pass over this just briefly, since it gets into intensive Semitics, but there are proper nouns, both personal names and also place names, which I think are best analyzed as being Mut Theophoric, or as having Mut as the God name as part of them, much like all of the Yah names in the Bible are Yahweh Theophoric names. So that's all sort of background. This is how I think we see Mut in the passage. But I want to turn now to the main content that I hope to talk about today, which is Mut as a mother and as the divine wet nurse, or the nourrice divine. So first I'll call your attention back to the fact that in the passage, Isaiah makes fun of his opponents, those who are getting drunk and participating in this so-called covenant as babies, as small children. He says that they are like children who are just, you know, come from the breast, who've just left the breast of their mother. So we recall, first of all, that mut, as a word in standard Middle Egyptian, is the common word for mother. And in fact, Egyptologists think that that's the true root of her name, that she was named primarily as a mother goddess originally. So this is why Isaiah mocks those who try to ally themselves to Egypt as children and babies seeking the help of a mother. But again, it's not simply mothering imagery. It's more specifically breastfeeding imagery, which is really emphasized rather strongly in this passage. So what do we make of that? Well, it turns out this has very strong Egyptian comparisons also. So here are some works of art featuring mut from a couple of different periods. This is Ramses II, I believe, in the center, suckling from the breast of mut. And then you have a 23rd dynasty pharaoh suckling at a 25th dynasty princess, Nefruka-Kashta. So this is right in Isaiah's time, also suckling at the breast of mut. And furthermore, from the Levant, we have even closer geographical data, which shows symbols of mut suckling her divine infant there. And again, some of these are the ones which have the name mut inscribed on them. So this is actually quite a close link that we can make between the two. Cushites are also mocked in their speech, seemingly as babies. I was pleased to see when I got here that the French translation, the Seconde, is actually one of the few popular translations that I found that I think rightly captures the sense of this verse here, where it's very challenging in Hebrew, but it says their speech will be tzav l'tzav, tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav, kav l'kav, and no one really is quite sure what that means. But in this context, as you see, it's often taken to be baby talk, and so the French is ba-ba, ba-ba, a-da-da-da, right, as a baby might speak. And I think that may be basically right. And the Cushites are specifically linked with a very similar phrase, which is also argued about, but in 18:2, they're called a Kav-Kav nation. So what's a Kav-Kav nation? So, some people try to take it from a root meaning strength, so if you look that up in your French Bible, that's probably what you'll find. But in fact, I think Kav-Kav is much like the Greeks would later say barbarians, right? Les barbares, n'est-ce pas? Here I think it's a mockery of the way that they talked. And in chapter 28, it's construed as baby talk. So, thus far, the case about Isaiah 28. Although all of this fits together rather well, it also leads, however, into potentially grave complexities, because the image of the nursing goddess is not limited to mut. In fact, many Egyptian goddesses appear in this motif, most famously Isis. Furthermore, the divine wet nurse motif is found throughout the ancient world. So which deity are we talking about in Isaiah 28, and is there any reason to see mut specifically here, really? So let's step back and look a little bit at the divine wet nurse motif more generally. So iconographically, it's a subset of what's called from the Greek root, the kurotrophos form, or the child carer or child rearer, kurotrophos. It's a subset of that. So usually the kurotrophos has the child on the lap. So the wet nurse image rather has the child also breastfeeding in the lap. So it's worth noting that this divine wet nurse motif has a strongly Egyptian background. Stephanie Boudin, whose book is also on your handout, who wrote the fullest analysis of the motif, wrote, "Egypt is ground zero for Mediterranean and Near Eastern chorotrophic iconography. It is here that the image has its oldest and longest lived existence." So, and this starts, as does much of Egyptian mythology, with the person of the pharaoh. And there are three points in the pharaoh's life when that image is used most commonly. Early childhood, so at birth, naturalistically, but also at the point where the pharaoh takes the throne he's shown as nursing at the goddess's breast, and also in the afterlife, because he's being seen as being born into the next life, so he needs to be nursed again. So, and this is pervasive, really, throughout Egyptian history. So the first attestation, as you see here on your slides, is from the pyramid texts, and I apologize for the lack of French on this one slide, but my main point here is just to call attention to the diversity of different goddesses who are named. So we have Isis, Nephthys, Unas's own mother, Nut, Selket, and then even gods. Even Horus, who's of course a male deity, is also portrayed as breastfeeding the pharaoh in the afterlife. So one of the strong features which Budin finds early on in the motif is the link with Nekhbet. Nekhbet is a southern Egyptian vulture goddess. And so this goes back really to the very prehistoric roots of Egyptian history. So you see Nekhbet here at the top of the slide, right? And she is protecting Narmer, who's one of the first known Egyptian pharaohs who's seated here with the crown. But here by Dynasty 5, so somewhat later in history, you see Nekhbet with her vulture headdress nursing the pharaoh Sahure. And she's called your great wild cow in the pyramid texts. So, and again, we note the vulture headdress. We note her titles, mistress of the divine house and mistress of the upper Egyptian divine palace. So it shows that divine wet nurse ideology. Later, as goddesses begin to be combined, there is a changing procession of deities who take on many of the same characteristics depending on the place and the period. So this, I'll show you some slides, but just note the progression here from Hathor to Mut to Isis. It's not quite that linear. It's far more diverse, but certain goddesses rise to prominence in different periods. So, for example, particularly in the reign of Hatshepsut, the famous female pharaoh of the New Kingdom, Hathor takes on great prominence. You see that sometimes Hathor is portrayed in cow form, but being nursed by a human figure like Hatshepsut. And in Hatshepsut's inscriptions, she says, Hathor says to her, I fill your majesty with life and happiness as I have done to my Horus. I have suckled your majesty with my breasts. And Hathor is also sometimes synchronized with Nekhbet, that southern vulture goddess. And here we see some other manifestations not from Hatshepsut's reign. This is Horemheb, the pharaoh. Later manifestations in the scholarly literature, you'll see this described as Isis. In a tree form, suckling Thutmose III. How one knows this is Isis is not entirely clear, because for one thing, Hathor is called Lady of the Sycamore. So just note that you have this kind of rampant syncretism, so that all these goddesses are sharing characteristics, whether it's nursing or trees or cows. These are all being shared across so many different goddesses. When Re was linked with Amun in Dynasty 18, Mut took the place of Hathor as the wife of the national high sun god. So we have these are the rough time period which followed her ascent. And again, particularly dynasties 25 and 26 were sort of classicizing dynasties in which they were seeking some of these older images of the nursing Mut goddess. And this is perhaps not surprising, since both Mut and Nekhbet were southern vulture goddesses. So that, the fact that that one can trace that particular thread all the way back through history, I think, is useful. Finally, by late in Egyptian history, all of the aforementioned goddesses get assimilated to Isis, as is visible in her temple at Philae. So we have Isis Horus as the final classic pairing, which I think scholars of classical art are probably most familiar with. So this is a Ptolemaic statue on the slide, rather late. And again, this is here's a further late manifestation showing more syncretism. So this is called Hathor at the temple of Dendera, but note she's now got the vulture headdress on. So she looks very much, it's very hard to distinguish between these goddesses, and it's really only where they're actually named in a text associated with the image that Egyptologists can really be sure. So I want to turn from the story of this divine wet nurse in Egypt to the story of how that image was received, I would say secondarily, outside of Egypt. So we have imagery of suckling of goddesses, for example, prominently of the god Marduk in the Enuma Elish, where it says, "In Apsu was Marduk born, in pure Apsu was he born. Ea, his father, begat him, Damkina, his mother, bore him. He suckled the breasts of goddesses, a nurse reared him and filled him with terror." From about the same time period, we have a cassite figurine, which also shows a goddess suckling, though it's not inscribed, so we don't know who's intended by the picture, but the headdress appears to be that of a goddess. Earlier, a king, Rim-Sin of Larsa, who toyed with making himself divinized, also has a broken text in which he claims to have nursed a boy, and it's very sad that we can't reconstruct more of the context, because it's an amazing claim for a human king to have claimed to have suckled a child, but so this appears to be part of that same motif also. But as you can note, this is a far more sparse attestation than from Egypt. Adugarit, and these are, this is an area in which your own Louvre has wonderful holdings that I've enjoyed while I'm here. We have this composite relief of a goddess possibly suckling two young men, possibly it's meant to be the same, but shown from the same single child shown from two perspectives. And you notice her strikingly diverse iconographic characteristics. So she has the Hathor headdress, she has the sort of Hathor Isis horns, maybe this is the same sun disk, though it's shrunken, but she also has wings, which the Egyptian goddesses never do. So it's not clear to scholars which goddess this is supposed to be. Is it meant to be Hathor? Is it meant to be Atherat or Asherah or one of the Levantine deities, Anat perhaps? So there's some argument over that. Hathor, of course, did have quite a presence on the Levantine seacoast. Even within Egypt itself, she's called the Lady of Byblos. So she's strongly linked with it. And then from Ugarit also, we have texts which attest to royal heirs suckling at the breasts of the goddesses. So in the Kirta epic, we have Yatsib, who's the son of the king Kirta, and it says he's the one who will suck the milk of Atheratu, who will drain the breast of the maiden Anat, the wet nurses of the gods. And then in a second broken text, about two somewhat mysterious figures, Shahar and Shalim, they're also said to suckle at the nipple of the breasts of the lady. So in the late Bronze Age, we have reception there, and it's attributed to native deities. where it's clear at all. From the Iron Age, somewhat later, we have a few more sparse attestations. This is a Neo-Hittite relief from Kara Tepe around 700 BC. And again, from the headdress, we can tell that it's a goddess, but we're not told who the goddess is suckling there as the child. And then in a visual representation from Syria, we have a Neo-Assyrian ivory plaque in which you have this sort of Hathor-like cow suckling its calf, which you see just from the iconographic structure here that there's a strong protective note here where the cow's body surrounds the entire calf. So you can tell that protection was in the mind of the artist, I think, in a case like this. In the Neo-Assyrian text, we get even more information, and in particular, Ishtar, whose prophetic cult was very important for the Neo-Assyrians. She's called the good wet nurse for the kings of Assyria. So Ashurbanipal and other of the Assyrian kings are said to have suckled at her breasts or her teats. And again, we see here again this link between the wet nursing and the protection. So have no fear, you whose wet nurse is the lady of Arbela. Like a wet nurse, I carry you, right? I put you between my breasts. So it's this strangely sort of infantilizing picture of even the king himself, which apparently was not seen as a problem by those who employed it or those who were portrayed. As a final note, this is something that I'm still working on, even at the moment, and haven't solved to my satisfaction, but there's a striking passage in the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon, in which he's warning his vassals not to make treaties with, or not to conspire with those who would wish to conspire with them. And then he says, so you shall not conclude a treaty before the gods, either in setting a table, in drinking a cup, in lighting a fire, or by water, or by oil, or by taking hold of and the word is toule in Akkadian. And it's not clear to me whether this is simply meant to be some kind of a kind of manly gesture of like, hand to hand on chest, or if this is actually supposed to be a picture of sort of seizing the breast of a supportive figure, like they would for the goddess, or even for Horus or Rim Sin, who were masculine figures. I think there's some case to be made that the latter might be in view here, but I don't have enough data yet, frankly. So we know that even in the wider ancient Near East, in Isaiah's times, like those are all roughly 8th, 7th century texts. So in Isaiah's time, we know that this wet nurse image was still fairly widespread, but in Judah, strikingly, we do get these so-called fertility figurines. They're sometimes called goddess figurines. They have sort of exaggerated breasts, but they're never made in these simple native forms with the child. So there's no actual nourrice figure that seems to have been native to the Levant. So this is based on the work of Othmar Kael and Christoph Eulinger, who notes that the divine wet nurse disappears after about the year 1000 in the Iron I period. However, as I mentioned, divine wet nurse figures did continue to be made and used, but the ones that are found are all in this very, very, very Egyptianized form. Now that, I think, is striking. There were more than 20 of these which have been found from the Iron Age from such locations as Megiddo, Beit Shan, Beit Shemesh, and Lachish. Most are not inscribed, but two do bear the name of Mut, such as the one that you see up there, which reads, words said by Mut, the lady I give life and protection to the justified. So no, life and protection. This is exactly what Isaiah 28 seems to have in mind. So again, that protective aspect comes to the fore in the Iron Age diaspora of this image. So in the material evidence, we perhaps have indications of a continuing use of the image on the boundaries. I'll note two more examples, which I think are perhaps the most striking material data that we can adduce for this theme. This one, which has been known for some time from Tel Kassire near Tel Aviv, is here it's called a statue, but in fact it's got a means to pour liquid through it, and you see the holes in the breast. So one can pour things in the top and it comes out the breast. Now what this was used for, no one knows. They should do some testing through Tel Aviv on the residue inside, just to see if that was milk or wine or what. Then more recently, and I've found this in one presentation from the brand new Kirbet Kayafa excavations, which are 10th century probably, but this is a very striking vessel, which is also, it's got a hole that one could pour things out, and then two bulbous appendages, which one could drink from. So I don't think that archaeologists have come to any strong conclusions about what that was used for, but it is possibly suggestive of some kind of a cultic breastfeeding activity, if you will. So if I may then, just to sort of round this towards some first conclusions, three points about the reception in Judah in the late 8th century of this motif. If the divine wet nurse in Isaiah 28 is a symbol of the Cushites from the deep south, then Mut is a strong candidate for that figure. The motif in Egypt may be particularly associated with southern goddesses. Thus, it's not surprising to find the southern vulture goddess Mut associated with it, in line with the earlier associations with Nekhbet. Budin argues that in almost punning fashion, Nekhbet assumes strongly maternal characteristics, and this notion appeared early in her more anthropomorphic depictions, notably in that Sahari funerary complex, which I showed you. Though this is a disputed point that Nekhbet is a central goddess for this figure. But by the first millennium, the syncretism among Egyptian and Levantine goddesses was so extensive and thoroughgoing that it would probably be artificial to argue that any one of those discussed here is more likely than the others, apart from the literary context given in the passage. So second, the use of the divine wet nurse motif is probably not limited to royalty, despite the indications to the contrary. Although, at least through the Bronze Age, our reception of the wet nurse motif in general seemed to be built largely around the royal association. So it's the kings and the royal heirs who are most associated with it. But we should not be surprised to find the motif also extended to the protection of others, such as the priests and leaders of Judah in Isaiah 28. Because already in the New Kingdom, Egyptian imagery had been extended not just to the king, but to queens and to other people in the court. And again, the protective aspect is quite important, as we saw in the Neo-Assyrian texts. And the amuletic Mut representations, the basic point of amulets is protection, right? The one that wears it hopes that it will have a magical effect for them. Finally, on this point, the idea that the king had wholly different expectations from other people in the cultures has recently come under staunch critique by Egyptologists. So whereas 20, 30 years ago, Egyptologists talked quite easily about the so-called democratization of death, now they've come to realize that, in fact, everybody probably had the same hopes for death. It's simply that not all people had equal opportunity to write about it. So first, only kings could write about it than others could. I think the same thing may be true of the divine wet nurse motif, that in fact this was a widespread hope for the afterlife, only written about by those few people that had the access to writing technology. Third point, in Israel and Judah, the divine wet nurse appears to have fallen under the same prophetic critique as other aspects of the goddess. So in Israel and Judah specifically, the native appropriation of the wet nurse disappears. Insofar as it appears in Israel and Judah, it is in explicitly foreign form in those Egyptianizing amulets, which do continue to be well attested. So therefore, divine wet nurse imagery came to be marked as foreign, which in this case it was, and also as heterodox, as condemned under what would come to be, in Isaiah's view, Orthodox Yahwism, if I dare even use that word. In this respect, so the cultural reaction against this specific image may have been more successful than the reaction against goddesses in general, since goddesses continued to be embraced as attested by, for example, Asherah poles or the fertility goddess figurines, which I showed you. Although I must note, as a second thought about this same issue, since it's not just in the territory of, say, Judah, where these divine wet nurse figurines disappear, but rather seemingly in the whole Iron Age Levant, it may well be something in the wider culture, a reaction against the divine feminine more generally. So I'm indebted somewhat here to Professor Romer's work in his new book, The Invention of God, in which he also talks about the loss of the divine feminine. And so we may well be talking about wider cultural aspects. But again, in closing, it's possible that the loss of the divine wet nurse was in fact a function of the prophetic critique by Isaiah and his contemporaries. But if I may mention one last thing, one may beat back these thousands of years long yearnings of the human heart or soul for certain kinds of mythological comfort. But in fact, they never seem to stay away. So in the Bible, we have ample representation that in fact the God of Israel was associated with this type of imagery, sometimes in a rather vague form. So in Genesis 49, we read that God is the God of the blessings of the breasts and of the womb. So there's some association there. But in the later parts of Isaiah, this comes back even more forcefully. So in Isaiah 49, we read, "Can a woman forget her nursing child or show no compassion for the child of her womb?" And the answer is no. Or in Isaiah 60, "You shall suck the milk of nations, you shall suck the breasts of kings," striking. So again, here it's not quite yet Yahweh still, but we're working back towards a comfort level with this type of imagery. And then in Isaiah 66, this is also quite a striking passage, in which, in calling the people back to Jerusalem, God says, "You will be fed with milk, and you'll be taken back to the breast." And here it's of the city, but there's a very strong association between the city and the deity. So again, we're getting even closer, but it becomes full blown even later on in texts called the Odes of Solomon. And I apologize once again for the lack of a French translation, but this is very explicit stuff. So the speaker here sees a cup of milk offered to him, and "I drank it in the sweetness of the delight of the Lord. The Son is the cup, and he who was milked is the Father, and the Holy Spirit milked him because his breasts were full." So these are the two breasts of the Father. So this is not in the canon of the Bible, but this is in the Qumran period or in the first or later in the second century CE. And it's not just a, you know, just a one-off either. In one of the other odes of the same collection, God says, "My own breasts I prepared for them that they might drink my holy milk and live thereby." And this continues on even into the canon of the New Testament. So Paul says, "I could not speak to you as a spiritual people, but rather as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you are not ready for solid food." Or in 1 Thessalonians 2, "We were gentle among you like a nurse," using the same Greek word trophos that we've been talking about, tenderly caring for her own children. And then I would just note that we can continue the iconographic tracing also into the Christian period. So we've already seen these Isis Horus motifs. This is once again Ptolemaic. These are also Greco-Roman portrayals of Isis and Horus. In the Christian period, Mary and Jesus are portrayed in almost precisely the same iconographic configuration. So, and of course, in the Catholic Church's veneration of Mary, we may see echoes of the same sort of human yearning for that divine wet nurse or mother figure. Here a couple more. On the left, we have a Rigononi from 1485. On the right, a Byzantine icon from 1784. And then I was wandering through the Louvre on this visit, and I stumbled on this by Barnaba da Modena from 1370. So quite popular, quite widespread. As Professor Romer mentioned to me in a conversation this morning, Mary is called the Queen of Heaven in certain medieval texts, and of course that's also what Jeremiah used and condemned in chapter 44 of his book. So long continuing patterns, even in contemporary hymns. And I haven't tried to translate this one because the rhymes wouldn't continue, but I hope you'll follow. This is a Methodist hymn from the U.S. from 1994. And it reads, "For God our way, our bread, our rest, of all these gifts the giver, our strength, our guide, our nurturing breast, whose hand will yet deliver." So I mean, even up to
the
it's a wonderful hymn tune, but I'm not paid to sing. So these continue both in sort of, if you will, positive ways, in ways that are meant to be devotional for present-day Christians. But I would note that in keeping with Isaiah's own condemnation of that divine wet nurse image, this also continues to be controversial. And so I leave you with this last slide. This is a cover from Time magazine from just, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. And there was a bit of a scandal in the U.S. over mothers who were breastfeeding their children up to age 4 or 5, as you can see. And they put this picture on the cover to shock. And of course, it generated all kinds of angry responses, you know, that's obscene, or that's stupid to breastfeed that long. So there's something quite powerful about the imagery of breastfeeding, which has continued to evoke both positive and negative reactions across the centuries. So I thank you for joining me here, and I leave you with this picture of the problem of the goddess in Isaiah 28. So we have this sort of radical syncretism of the different goddesses, and I think it's time that we stop thinking in terms of discrete goddesses' names, because they appear to have been quite interchangeable. So every literary or iconographic manifestation needs to be understood in its own context based on the clues that were given internally rather than all assimilated to one particular goddess's name. So that, you know, that kind of literary flexibility, I think, is more more reflective of how art worked in history. So thank you for your time.